Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Several years ago, I gave a talk at Harvard for this really interesting conference called Editorial Aspirations. And you think about it, human hands, what Aristotle called the tool of tools, the symbol of our distinctive body form and unique capacities of mind, our comprehension, our creativity, and our control over the world in which we dwell. And these hands, these human hands, are now turning to operate on our very selves. So the question of soul is extremely important in our era, because now we, in a strange metaphorical sort of way, may have the capacity to do something about it. In other words, reshape the expressions of soul within our individual and species existence. According to the National Intelligence Council report, Global Trends 2030, Alternative Worlds, we are at a critical juncture in human history which could lead to widely contrasting futures. So what is this era we're in, this amazing combination of converging technologies in biology and information technology, leading to important, urgent indeed, advances in biomedicine, but also in more fundamental agriculture? Nowhere is the statement by the National Intelligence Council more evident than the promise and peril of advancing biotechnology and associated applications of information technologies. We need to have a sense of who we are, what is our source, what is the organizing principle of our existence, and where we're heading individually and collectively. And this is the sense in which I'm going to use the term soul today, to the degree I even mentioned soul, and that is in the sense that Aristotle used it, and Aquinas, of course, richly was embedded in Aristotelian perspectives. The soul as the entelechy, the principle of organization and operation of the human organism. And I think that I can't say very much about how that relates to eternal matters, except that I think it's evident that it sets the orientation of our individual lives and our collective lives, especially as a Christian community, toward things that transcend the earth itself. And I believe in Christ's incarnation, redemptive action, and the resurrection of the dead, all of which mean that the concept of soul in human existence, while it may be interesting and important to study its expression as a material manifestation, that it has implications and, in fact, destiny beyond the individuality of our biochemical being. So that gives you the larger frame in which I want to approach this. So here we are in this amazing moment in advancing technologies, together with recent insights from ethology, which is the study of animal behavior, new perspectives and powers associated with advances in genetics, neurobiology, cognitive psychology, artificial intelligence, and robotics are blurring the boundaries between humans, animals, and machines, and raising conceptual and practical problems of profound importance for the human future. What is the meaning of apparent mind, emotion, and moral awareness in animals? Are humans, as some maintain, just another ordinary animal species? What are we to make of predictions of conscious machines? Wow, why is not this advancing? What are we to make of predictions of conscious machines? Neuromorphic computers, robotic servants, caregivers, and by some visions, even companions. Can human nature be reduced to information processing? Are we, as MIT Professor Marvin Minsky said, just meat machines? Will biotech-mediated enhancements of physical and mental powers open new horizons or disrupt fundamental aspects of our humanity? Should we alter human physiology to increase our sensory range, or dramatically extend human lifespan, or genetically alter our offspring to enable interplanetary space travel? I mean, a very crucial question is, how does soul relate to the location of our origins, the creature of the Earth? So what are we to do with our technology if we don't have a proper concept of what it is the integrating principle and purpose of our lives? So what issues of human dignity arise in this context? With laboratory creation of synthetic embryos, which are now, as you probably know, emerging as a new technology, or human-animal chimeras. Don't worry, this is not actually a photograph, it's just a drawing. So it hasn't happened yet like this, but it could. So what are we to make of this? So what similar issues arise with human-machine cyborgs, brain-computer interfaces, or modular neural implants? What are we to make of proposals for the de-extinction, in other words, bringing back into being our early hominid cousins and ancestors like Neanderthals and Denisovans, or the transhumanist projects for the evolution by design of future humans? They argue that our advancing genetics and neurotechnologies offer us the opportunity to escape the constraints and cruelties of an amoral evolutionary process to lift humanity to the next level of personal and social flourishing as human, machine, hybrid post-humans. And they've got very big ambitions. This guy, William Hazeltine, was a very respected scientist, and yet he says the real goal is to keep people alive forever, and he doesn't have in mind in eternity God's kingdom. He has in mind on the earth. So what are we to make of all this, and how are we to govern it without a proper concept of who we are? Driven by urgent human problems in agriculture, environmental science, and biomedicine, global expenditures on biotechnology and biologically related research and development is expected to reach half a trillion dollars within the next few years. Building on earlier scientific revolutions in chemistry and physics, the pace and momentum of advances in basic biology and translational biomedicine is simply staggering. You know, while we argue about politics and finances and all that sort of stuff, meanwhile, there are these amazing overarching challenges largely being neglected by the population, by the citizenry. And they are what's truly different about our age. We know there have always been wars, famines, and financial crises, but no generation has had the power to intervene to reorganize the human body with genetic editing or putting computer interfaces into our brains. So we really have some very profound challenges, and I really love speaking to the Thomistic Institute groups, because I think it's you guys who have the right orientation to help our civilization think through these challenging questions. So let's dig in and ask, what is it? How would we think about these matters, and how can we then govern our technology in an intelligent way? Clearly, we're entering into a multi-generational era of unprecedented advances in our ability to intervene at every level of human biology. And at the heart of these dilemmas are fundamental philosophical and theological questions regarding the source and significance of human life and our place and purpose as co-creators within the cosmic order. Questions of what it means to be human and how these technologies relate to our ultimate destiny individually and collectively as a species made in the image of God, Imago Dei. Notwithstanding the headlines on politics and economics, these are the questions of your generation, and you need to address these if you're going to serve our society in guiding the future. So as we explore the varied approaches it's immediately apparent that two radically distinct and seemingly incompatible terms, terms of description, frame our self-understanding. One from the detached and objective view of the empirical sciences, you know, this physical and mathematical description, and the other from the subjective inward experience as sensitive, passionate, and purposeful living beings. The descriptive terms of the physical sciences, matter and energy expressed in the language of mathematics, are in sharp contrast with the more human-level approaches of phenomenology, aesthetic thought, and personalism, where concepts such as mind, beauty, and spirit are often used to refer not just to humans, but to the perceived core realities of the cosmos. As physicist Russell Stannard noted, we draw on this more personal level when we describe the very source and sustaining power of all reality. Our language about God as creator and ground of being is drawn from inward experience and expressed in personal terms. Such terms as love, purpose, compassion, goodness, and morality, expressions that, as according to Russell Stannard, do not figure in physics equations, nor in computer models, I might add. He goes on to say that the language used in reference to God is fundamentally that of consciousness, the aspect of human life that is at once most objectively evident, and we all know we're conscious beings, yet it's the most inexplicable of mysteries within our current conceptual and methodological tools. We just don't have a grasp on it. As we came in the door, one of your colleagues here asked me, what's the relation between soul, consciousness, and mind? And that is an enormous challenge for your generation. So which traditions or intuitions should we trust, our current science or our longstanding religious ideas? A good first step would be to acknowledge that much that is remains beyond the reach of our current scientific tools and methodologies, and despite the remarkable advances of the empirical approach, the natural sciences, much of the science of the human person remains deeply mysterious, which is why the transhumanists use the symbol H+, we're going to enhance humans, why it's very arrogant. We just don't know enough to even project those, much less operate those ambitions effectively. So on a practical level, what is needed is comprehensive wisdom, a comprehensive wisdom-seeking inquiry initiated with the goal of gaining a deeper understanding of human nature, of human purpose, and the challenges and opportunities of advancing technologies, which essentially is an invitation to understand the concept of soul as it actually is expressed in an embodied creature. Through thoughtful consideration of how we differ from other animal species and current and foreseeable intelligent machines, we can seek a richer perspective on the biological, social, and spiritual implications of our particular embodied form and inward expression as human beings. And I would say again, above all, this needs to be humbly approached and respectfully, and I would say even reverently approached. How many of you have read the books, any of the books, Sapiens, Homo Deus, by this guy, Yuval Noah Harari? Oh, I'm actually kind of glad most of you haven't, because he's a very graceful writer and very convincing guy, but he's not right about a lot of what he writes, I'm convinced. I'd love to debate him publicly. He gets $50,000 every time he appears on stage. I don't get paid that. too bad. But anyway, he says, sapiens will upgrade itself in another kind of being. Within a couple of centuries at most, Earth will be populated by beings who are different from us in their cognitive, physical abilities. Frankly, I hope not. But who knows? Maybe not to the advancement of humanity if we do that. We're part of a vast and integrated, comprehensive system of ecological unity, and we have to be very careful what we do. So to begin our consideration of the meaning of soul and the distinctiveness of human beings, We can first begin by comparing humans and machines. And it seems like, well, that must be very hard to do, but at least at this point in our technological progress, it's easier. No one denies that humans are animals or that animals resemble humans in important respects. The question has always been, what kind of an animal? Or how different from other animals are we? But what does it mean, as is being said in our current world, what does it mean if we are machines? Or perhaps more disturbingly, that some machines are like us? And what does it mean to say that our minds are a technology? Like other technologies, in being a set of mechanisms for the routine solution of a class of problems, we need to address these complicated questions, and we need to get a framing sense of what it is we are in order to go forward in the future. Humans, animals, and machines. Information. So, what is the source of our being? What is the orienting principle of our being? And what are the principles of understanding that will distinguish us from these things around us, these biological and mechanistic beings or creatures or creations? And how will we understand ourselves in this context? Is our mind just another technology like other technologies, a mechanism for the routine solution of a class of problems? That's a very challenging question, because we certainly know that there are biomechanical mechanisms mediating this. But is that all that we are? Can a mathematical description, a physical description, reduce us to that? I don't think so. But the human mind, and why not? And it's because the human mind is something else. When you go back to that quote about technologies, if you really think about it for a minute, there's something not quite right in saying that. Something has been smuggled in to these assumptions without our barely noticing. And that is that the human mind, in fact, is an embodied mind mysteriously issuing forth from within a living organism. Inseparably, body and mind, a psychophysical unity. That is the way we experience ourselves. Sometimes feeling like we're free-floating thought, but then acutely brought back to our physical frame, especially if we bump into something or step on a tack, we're suddenly physical. What's going on in that mind of that man with all his memories and his personal experiences, his feelings, his hopes? Something is much more mysterious than just a series of biochemical processes. So, though it's a mystery, the intuition, and the intuition could be wrong, it does seem that the mind is materially mediated and therefore arises within minuscule molecular motions that we call mechanism, and therefore it is a technology of sorts, sort of. But even if the mind is materially mediated, it is more than a mechanism, since it apprehends and draws into awareness concepts and ideas, immaterial realities that are as real or more real than matter. And by the way, who knows what matter is anyway? If you really talk to physicists, my brother has a PhD in physics, and when I talk to him about it, he cannot explain matter. Matter and mind are mysteriously joined in the minds of some in the thoughts and theories of some very, very profound physicists. So the mind is internally operated, not just externally ordered like a human-created machine. There is a self there with qualities of consciousness, including sentience, subjectivity, feelings, and sense of freedom that are very unlike a mechanism. Computational machines, computers, and human reasoning may seem similar in their logical operation and cause and effect relations, but in the human mind, there are other kinds of thinking, surrounding, suffusing, and strategically deploying the raw computational powers of mind. We have hopes and fears, sifting, sorting, searching for solutions with meaning and personal significance, what has been called the enchanted loom. early in the computer revolution, Stanford psychologist David Rummelhart famously said, "The knowledge is in the connections." And though at the time it was a brilliant insight regarding machine operations and has been a key to the development of neural networks and machine learning, taken literally, it cannot be true. There is no knower in a computational device. The computer knows nothing of the content or meaning. It has no sense of experience, no center of awareness. Even the terms it is trained on are reduced to digital tokens to be sifted, sorted, and shuttled in the search for mathematical ratios and statistically predictive patterns. It is neutral with regard to purpose, values, and genuine knowledge. I think we all know that, even if we're a little frightened by predictions of conscious machines. So here's an amazing statement by Leibniz. "Moreover, it must be confessed that perception and that which depends on it are inexplicable on mechanical grounds, that is to say, by means of figures and motions. And supposing there were a machine so constructed as to think, feel, and have perception, it might be conceived as increased in size while keeping the same proportion so that one might go into it as into a mill. That being so, we should, on examining its interior, find only parts which work one upon another and never anything by which to explain a perception." Wow, what an amazing insight that is. The astrophysicist Arthur Eddington puts it more plainly. "Our knowledge of physics is only an empty shell, a form of symbols. It is knowledge of structural form and not knowledge of content. All through the physical world runs that unknown content, which must surely be regarded as the stuff of our consciousness." But what is that unknown content that Eddington speaks of? And how does human consciousness grasp hold of it? 25 years ago, Terry Winograd, professor of computer science at Stanford, I know him personally, he's part of my Boundaries project, really nice guy, who's Larry Page's mentor. Larry Page started Google, okay, so Terry Winograd mentored Larry Page. Anyway, 25 years ago, Terry said, "The human mind is infinitely more complicated than mathematical logic would allow. That the patchwork rationalism, reasoning with simple facts and rules, that had guided AI for the previous 30 years was a misuse of analogy and a wrong-minded approach. He stated plainly, seekers after the glitter of intelligence are misguided in trying to cast it in the base metal of computing. Winograd cautioned that computers may be better understood as language machines, machines that manipulate symbols, machine code rather than thinking machines. But he noted that human language, unlike machine code, ultimately depends on the tacit understanding of the speakers. It's not susceptible to mechanically determinable mathematical logic." And we've all been disturbed, I think, even those of you who are computer scientists and know what's going on are disturbed by ChatGPT. The first time I used it, I was just astonished by how it could put together meaningful sequences of ideas. It was uncanny. It felt like somebody was talking back to us in conversation. In fact, what it's doing is simply using mathematical statistical operations to identify patterns and connections in our language. And a few months after that came out, I ran into the former president of Stanford, John Hennessy, who was very important in developing neural networks and so forth. And I said to him, "Wow, John, it's amazing how ChatGPT seems to reflect that there's a lot more going on in language than we realized." And he said, "Yeah, it shows you that the division between semantics, meaning, and syntax, structure, is artificial, that structure contains a lot of meaning. So, for example, if we make a sentence like, the old red barn, that feels fine. But if you hear the sentence, the red old barn, it's the same words, But you know right away there's something different in the meaning it's saying. If the red old barn is the sequence of words is operating that way, you know that there has to be some meaningful reference to red, not just the old red barn, but the red old barn. You know right away that that's what's being highlighted. In other words, those two sentences, even with the same words, have a different meaning. And that's just a very subtle thing, but that's all through our language, which, as I'll say as we go here, is deeply related to metaphors that are based on the body. Issues like attraction and force of an argument. It's based on a physical metaphor, those words we use in our common language. And ChatGPT picks up on this statistically and operates in it. So there's something amazing going on. Tacit knowledge is the key here. Understandings that are not susceptible to mechanistically determinable mathematical logic. You have to be a being that feels these things to understand it. Tacit, as implicit, implied but not stated, with a content that's understood but not expressed. And maybe it's inexpressible in terms like mathematics. Tacit knowledge, the broad awareness of reality, something grasped through the active experience of living, inseparably thought and feeling, known within the fullness of embodied being. Tacit knowledge, carried unconsciously as the background context for every thought and embedded in every expression of human language, but irreducible to mathematical logic. For the human mind, this term tacit was described by Michael Polanyi as personal knowledge. As he explained, we can know more than we can tell. He went on to say that not only is there knowledge that cannot be adequately articulated by even verbal means, but also that all knowledge is rooted in such tacit knowledge because we're beings. Our language just distills the sort of infrastructure of our thoughts, but the thoughts and feelings are much deeper than language can even completely express to one another. If one steps back to consider more deeply what is actually going on in the embodied human mind, it's clear that it is dramatically unlike machine processing. The flesh and blood human being, the organismal self, is a distinct human awareness of existential realities, of personal place and purpose within the world. Every one of you carries this sense of the autobiographical self. Like every organism, we dwell in a precarious position of being, potent but perishable. And as with all sentient beings, passionate and purposeful. Everybody, one of you in this room, like I do, knows you're going to die. You know that your life has some meaning in the process of living. And you know that this churning and bubbling within the multiple streams of pains and pleasures, of memories and aspirations, hopes and fears, is the defining structure of your personal identity and your sense of autobiographical self, the story of you, the story of yourself. This interpretive frame of tacit knowledge is of the personal autobiographical self, the narrative self, our sense of who we are, the nature of the world and our place within it. A vast and varied store of memories and personal intentions sets the context of every thought that you think and operate on. And these in turn are embedded within the interpretive context of our culture, within a mythological cosmology, and for many of you, a religious foundation of thought that frames your lives and gives you a sense of the purpose and being. This is the tacit understanding, the personal knowledge that flows forth from your sense that you are on a journey, a personal journey into the world. Today, the impoverished patchwork rationalism early AI has been superseded by deeper and more opaque processes of so-called machine learning, including the large language models. But algorithms, statistical models that these computers use to effectively perform tasks are built on human experience. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do anything. They're basically, these are mimic machines. They're mimicking input, knowledge that gleaned from the entire text on the entire internet. It's not amazing to think of. So these computer beings, if you will, whatever you call them, these machines have never had any direct experience. They're just parasitizing off of what you've experienced and then written about. Again, the machine is not like the human mind. It appears to employ an entirely different mode of operation, intense pattern recognition, a kind of brute force processing in search of functional solutions, lacking the subtlety and comprehensive personal content that characterizes each of your human cognitive processes. So ChatGPT is a master of prediction, mathematical correlation, not perception and meaningful thought. It is a mimic machine, not a truth seeker. And this brings us directly to the deep question, how we operate. It's clear computers don't think and brains do not simply compute. They do some computing, but they are not simply computers. They are, if anything, feeling devices. So that brings us to the really deep question of how do we know anything? How do we know what we know, and how does it arise, and what purposes guide it, and what is this quality of soul that has not just a physical, not just frames our physiological, anatomical being, but our sense of where the self that we all know we are is gaining meaning and gaining purpose, and where it's heading, what it all means. So to understand this, we need to understand how language arises and serves as a medium of communication and the bearers of human culture, and how it reflects the personal source that it is. To understand this, we need to recognize how these capacities are grounded in the structure and dynamic of our embodied existence, life lived within a world that speaks to us through our experience, both physical and interpersonal, as an intelligible language of being. In other words, we as living human beings are embedded in a world that has intelligibility in it. And we penetrate that intelligibility by our experience living in it. The given world is not just a neutral backdrop like a stage for us to live out our lives, but it's the ground of the tacit knowledge that infuses all thought, language, and action, and gives meaning. It is the ground of providing what we think of as the human factor in existence. So machine learning is, at least for now, I mean, I can't say this absolutely because nobody knows, and I certainly don't know as much as many people who are worried about this, but at least for now, machine learning is, at least for the moment, a metaphor, and it's not like, and like all metaphors, it carries certain limited analogies of similarity, but is not the thing to which it is compared. The Turing test, you all know what the Turing test is. I won't explain it because I'm sure you all know. The Turing test is not an indicator of a human consciousness in a computer, but of the measure of the gullibility of the human observer. If you think the machine talking to you has a human consciousness, you're gullible, at this moment anyway. Those who dispense wild speculations about complete uploading of the human mind in silico, are not thinking clearly. They're not reflecting properly on the indispensable role of the body, the organic substance that supports the functioning of a human consciousness with all the complexities of personal context and content that implies. And so these basic reflections on machines, physical substance of our existence, these reflections on tacit knowledge and embodied knowing lead us directly out of Silicon Valley to the marshlands and mountains on either side, directly back to living nature and the mystery of animal mind. And most problematically, the question of what is it that distinguishes the human species from all other living beings? And as you know, I'm sure the tradition in our Christian faith and in largely in our civilization is that there's a certain quality of mind, of rational soul behind this distinction. We are a rational soul. Boethius in the 5th century said that rational person is an individual substance of a rational nature. So what does it mean to be a rational being and yet be a biological being? And how does this quality distinguish us from other creatures? Throughout history, there have been repeated attempts to identify single distinguishing characteristics that define human nature and endow a privileged status within the natural and moral orders. So here's a partial list of them. It's quite fun to think about it. The laughing animal, the animal that cooks, the featherless biped, the only creature with a marked projection in the center of its face and nose, the only creature with genuine symbolic language, you know, we're starting to get at it, rational animal capable of the creation and transmission of culture, metacognition, thinking about thinking, self-awareness, moral conscience, theories of mind, and of course, the animal that blushes. Isn't that interesting? The animal that blushes. Why did that one get smuggled in? It's notable that throughout the long tradition of Western thought on this, there was reference to both body and mind. We sense the difference, the human difference, and the difference it makes are most deeply distilled in the meaning of minds, yet the body is there as well. And of course, the animal that blushes is a direct reference to the human body, but also implicitly a reference to mind. But mind in its inwardness, self-conscious, sensitive and socially aware mind, morally and spiritually alert to the boundaries of self-disclosure, shame, and our personal place within the larger arena of the human story. Mark Twain's quip, so there's the rational mind. Mark Twain's, that's Boethius. Mark Twain's quip, man is the only animal that blushes or needs to, is very illuminating, isn't it? In other words, other animals apparently are not ashamed of their bodily operations or their particular dispositions, but we are. We're sensitive to it. So how do these distinctive capacities arise? What are their material, psychological, and social foundations? It's increasingly clear that they have deep roots in the origins of life. But again, as with computers, it's easy to overinterpret similarities as identity. And again, the misplaced metaphors can work in both directions. Like we said, computers, our brain was like a computer, and now we're saying computers are like our brains. But same with animals. Misplaced metaphors can work, considering animals as persons with human rights, or viewing all human motivations and intentions as serving basic biological models and basic needs, man as simply a beast. I mean, none of us, however mysteriously we may share things like basic DNA, none of us can resist the power of thinking of these little creatures in the Beatrix Potter books as little human beings operating. I mean, Peter Rabbit, I mean, who doesn't love Peter Rabbit? Anybody doesn't love Peter Rabbit, put your hand up, you can leave. Peter Rabbit just seems so human to us. Doesn't look like something we should have in a stew, but he's an animal. He's not a rational being in the sense that humans are. So what's going on? Though we share many capacities with animals, including certain aspects of intelligence, it's important to recognize that a quantitative difference can be the basis of a qualitative difference. A difference of degree can be a difference of kind. And the human brain is 3.5 times bigger than expected for an ape of our size. Likewise, reorganization of anatomical, physiological, and neurological characteristics and novel combinations of functions can lead to radically new emergent properties. Though we share all the basic brain parts with other mammals, their proportions and functional dominance of their interconnections differ in important ways. The hierarchy of neural refinements converges in the prefrontal cortex, the center of abstract analysis, planning and decision-making, and rational comprehension and control. And that region of our brains is 5 times larger than similar area in the chimp brain. Moreover, even small mutations or changes in how genes are regulated, same gene but different quantity and chronology of gene expression, can work, especially through early development, to produce dramatic differences in anatomical and neurologic changes, for example, in the vocal apparatus, which allows spoken language. Most animal vocalizations seem to be under emotional control rather than cognitive control. They're automated information exchanges, fixed action patterns, limited in ability of flexibility and meaning. Typically, they have to do animal communication, animal language typically has to do with reproduction, food issues, and alarm. Even great apes do not seem to have the voluntary fine motor control of the facial muscles of voice that we use for speech, and their vocal apparatus does not enable articulation of the required vowels essential for speech. Isn't that amazing? Our closest ancestors are dramatically different. I got to tell you about Coco the gorilla. So Coco, everybody knows about Coco, right? So Coco, the so-called talking ape, Coco was actually lodged right up above where I live, just 10 minutes up the hill. And Penny Patterson, who raised Coco and so-called taught Coco all this language, invited me up. I spent a whole afternoon with Coco, and I was prepared to be radically disrupted in what I thought animal creatures, non-humans, could do. But actually, to be perfectly honest about it, I came down the hill and I thought, well, our traditions aren't so foolish. Coco's not just 99% human. Coco spent most of the afternoon pointing at my mouth, and Allison will like this, pointing at my teeth because I have some gold fillings. And Coco wanted to see my gold fillings over and over. And when it came to talking about anything of substance, well, there was no real conversation going on. It was very, very basic. Coco did enjoy eating pizza and having Cokes for lunch, by the way, which I thought was a little bit weird. But anyway, so there's Penny with Coco. And yeah, Coco could mimic seeming language, but I was pretty unimpressed by it. Anyway, maybe I'm being too negative. As one scientist, contrary to Penny's conclusions, as one scientist said, even where apes have been taught to use signs and symbols to communicate, their range and depth of expression is very limited. And he goes on to say, we can teach them to speak, in quotes, but they have nothing to say. Isn't that interesting? Human speech, on the other hand, is primarily driven by cortical areas in the left hemisphere that allow for voluntary control and extreme flexibility. With its unlimited range of sequential sounds, human language allows the communication of a vast range of ideas, setting the essential foundations for cooperative sociality, teaching, and the transmission and accumulation of culture. This distinctive example of anatomic and neurologic revision allows a greater range of response, and it may be the key to the broader foundation of human freedom and foundation of human uniqueness. So, prefrontal cortex, vocal apparatus, higher levels of integrated processing in our brains, allowing fantastic new neurologic dimensions to emerge in the neurobiology of expression of soul, if you will. So just to give you a sense of how this operates in animal existence, most animals are driven by fixed action patterns. And these patterns are, it's almost like a little trigger, a stimulus sets them in motion, and then the animal mindlessly does what it does after being conditioned and evolved to this. So this is This is a goose, and the goose, of course, needs to keep the eggs. Let's see if I can get this to keep the eggs in the nest. So the goose is responsive to the curvature of the egg. And you can take a billiard ball and put it in front, and the goose feels compelled to draw it back into the nest. That's a fixed action pattern. The goose, if it had a real thoughtful understanding, would say, that's not an egg, that's a billiard ball. But there it is. Nice little goose. Okay, enough of that. So what does this mean, that human beings are flexible and have other kinds of freedom? Well, it certainly means we have, at the very least, a vast range of choice, but also that it's controlled not by fixed action patterns, but by integrative, higher level thought, rational processes, creative, imaginative processes. The French existentialist, Simone de Beauvoir was Sartre's lover. And she once said, human beings are that species which by nature has no nature. But of course, that's very silly, actually. I mean, as interesting as it may be as a statement, we obviously have a nature. And that nature is built on exceedingly rarefied and refined physical structures that simply are not amenable to playing around with without destroying it. It's sort of like you bought a $350,000 sports car and you think you're going to fix it by shooting it with a shotgun with gene editing or something. You have no idea what we're doing. And we could really displace the powerful foundations of our being. 3.5 pounds of the most complexly integrated organic chemistry in the known universe. That integrated all within a living body. That's what arises the fundamental powers of self-consciousness. Chemicals come to consciousness is what we are. And if we stop and pause in the next few minutes as I finish here and think about what it is that's special about human beings, we start to understand that there's something amazing going on, that somehow or another organic chemistry has arranged itself in such a way that fantastic new powers and possibilities arise within the organic substance that is the substrate of life. I want to show you this just to show you. The first principle here is how powerfully flexible and potential, if you will, organic chemistry actually can be. We don't ponder this. This is a series of bacteria there, and this video I'm going to show you here is a neutrophil, a white blood cell, chasing bacteria, and this would happen in your bloodstream, that this is probably in a dish since they're photographing it, but you watch the little black dots of the bacteria and the white blood cells chasing the bacteria. The white blood cell does not have what we'd call a mind. It doesn't have a brain. It's a single cell. And yet it follows down based on chemotaxis, chemical signals. It chases down the bacteria just with apparent intentionality of a higher order being, and finally grabs it. I've showed that some places where people start clapping for the neutrophil, like they're rooting for it. But that's just basic mechanism. But isn't that amazing how flexible and potent organic chemistry can be? And of course, we all know within these mysterious creatures, living beings, there's the emergence of emotions, memory, and a sense of self. Slowly, a phylogeny, we get this more distilled and more capable sense of self, culminating in human beings who have not just the physical bodies for integrative thought inside their own minds, but the facial muscles and body form to express a huge amount, even non-verbally. The key to human cooperative sociality is, of course, our capacity to enter into intersubjectivity, that sense of feeling the other in yourself. And this is expressed primarily in the word empathy, but it's a very complicated set of refined musculature and perception, perceptual awareness of one another. And it's what's allowed human communication, shared language, culture development, and culture transmission. And governing all this is at the foundation, something that is quite analogous to the notion of soul. I think it's probably as good a word as we could put into the organic substance of soul is desire. What is soul? Soul means that to which the organism is organized and directed. And ultimately, our souls, if you will, are the personal process of our being with the aspirations that have been woven right into the very structure of our personal and personal sense of self and our interaction with the world, such that the Catholic tradition puts the highest order expression of soul as the beatific vision, the reuniting of ourselves individually and collectively within the participation within God. And our lives are directed toward operating within the world for our personal benefit and our collective benefit in the coming, the promotion of the kingdom of God. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Desire, purpose, not DNA, is the deepest principle of life. And that brings us to the final moment here of awareness of what we are in the human form. The human body is a fantastic interaction with the intelligible world in which we are embedded. Our upright posture is key to the kind of mind we could have. Our creative hands are the kinds of operations that feed our minds and take what our minds can conceive and enact them. So the human body, imago Dei, is not just some sort of abstract thinking capacity. It's the embodied being of our whole personal existence. Language, sociality, and the collective mind emerge from this. The cooperation and accumulation of culture reflect this capacity to interact, relate to one another. The face is the key here. Upright posture puts us in a disposition of face to face with one another. And the face is the indicator of the mind. This is crucial, and we all know it. We all experience it as we're growing up. But it starts very early in human development. At the breast, the little baby's looking up at his mother, eyes focus exactly at the distance between the baby's eyes when it's nursing and the mother's mouth and eyes. And the tremendous amount of communication goes on. They're nourished by oxytocin, the dispositional molecule that puts us into a social frame of being. We become imitators, engaging very seriously. Our personal identity is fashioned within the sense of participation in the larger community of human beings. And then, of course, it becomes the basis of language and talking with one another, sharing our identity. What a joyful, wonderful beauty it is. And by the way, just so there's a little parenthesis here. So many of my students at Stanford say they don't want to have children. And I just want to put in a little plug for children, because I mean, first of all, we'll die as a species. We'll die as a civilization. Elon Musk is right about that. But for whatever it's worth, and you guys make up your own minds, and I'm not trying to tell you anything that's by way of imposing on you, but in my own existence and the existence of almost everybody else I know who's had children, they say that in the final end is what gave them the central axis of meaning in their earthly life. So if you're thinking of not having kids because you want to have some fascinating career, maybe there's a special avocation or calling for you there, and I don't want to say there isn't. But if it's just that you want to travel a lot and eat out at boutique restaurants and be liberated from all responsibilities that relate to the difficult task and struggles and sufferings of raising children, I think you're actually making a wrong mistake. And at least that's my thought about it. And you can't wait, those of you who are women, you cannot wait too long to have children, because starting at about age 30, your fertility curve goes down at an almost 45 degree angle to the early 40s, and you just can't snap your fingers and have a baby at 35, 36 years old. That's not how it works. I'll tell you, I'll take a moment here because I think it's so important. I had a conversation with the head of the largest infertility, or in other words, fertility medicine clinic in the world. It was the New York Infertility Center. And he told me, and he was not a religious man as far as I could tell, he said, well, a huge number of our patients, like half of our patients, are women over the age of 35 who are desperate to have a baby. And only maybe a third of them, using IVF and all the other fertility technologies and modern medicine, only maybe a third of them will ever have a baby. They waited too long. And then he said to me, and the tragedy of it is that a huge number of them earlier in their lives aborted the only baby they ever had in their womb. I've seen it. In my medical training, I think the worst suffering I witnessed was not people with cancer or multiple sclerosis or something like that. It was people who wanted to have a baby and couldn't do it because they waited too long. So that's just, okay, I said it. You can shoot me if you think I'm being sexist or talking out of turn, but that's what I think, and I think it's time we talked about this as a culture. Your soul is oriented toward person production. Did you ever ponder how the Trinity and its mystery is actually the whole foundation of the Trinity is God the Father in his love and his generosity and his desire to share is a person producer. He produces the second person of the Trinity, the Son, and this love between them is another person, meaning an expression of being. The love between the Father and the Son is the Holy Spirit. If God in his very nature is a person producer, what an amazing thing that he puts in our bodies the capacity to participate in person production. What an amazing mystery is that you can be connected with another human being in the foundations of sacred love and bring forward into the world another person or a whole household full of them, little people. I gave a talk at St. John's College in northern Minnesota some years back. Over lunch, they were talking about genetic diseases and intervening with technologies and genetic diseases, and somebody was saying how important this is going to be. We get rid of things like Fragile X syndrome, which is, you know, it's serious. You didn't want to wish for a child with it, but you get a child, you love the child. So the guy sitting next to me heard this, and he said, well, what do you mean? I have three brothers with Fragile X syndrome. It's pretty rare. And I said to him, wow, three brothers? How many brothers do you have? And he said, well, they're not all brothers, but 23 brothers and sisters. 23. And I said, are those all from the same mother? Yep. And they drive the tractors on the farm, and they're loving members of the community. Oh, my gosh. You don't have to have perfect lives to have meaningful lives, okay, guys? Your soul is oriented to experience and engage the sufferings of the world and thereby unite yourselves with the sufferings of Christ. The suffering that is love, loving suffering, that's what your life is about. You will not escape suffering. You need to learn and be brought through Christ's love into a meaningful relationship to suffering. You're part of this vast network of human culture, human expression. You have imagination, the highest order expression of your cognition, your capacity for rational mind. You can imagine what the future should be like. Your lives are all aired. I talked to some of your classmates this afternoon. They have deep aspirations. They have in their mind an imagined ideal of their future. And that's what we do. And beyond even our earthly imagination, we imagine our special role in a transcendent future that brings together the principles of truth, our highest aspirations, and the envisioned ideal. That's what the human soul is all about. And that's an embodied soul that is mediated by chemistry, but it has something far beyond the physical in it. And when we do think about biotechnology and producing the better world that's envisioned, and I'm a physician, I'm all in favor of advances in biomedicine, truly, but I think we should be careful. We need to understand the mystery and majesty of the human body and its embodied expression of soul. And human beings who are worth their salt will recognize the world as it is and the sufferings that go with being an embodied creature. Did you know that 10,000 children under the age of 5 die every single day on average? 10,000 children. So how are we to live? Do we all need to have a Ferrari and fancy vacations, or could we turn around and see what we're actually embedded in, a great need of humanity? So I'm very taken by St. Francis. I think St. Francis understood the meaning of being a body, of the meaning of soul. And here's Niels Bohr, crucial physicist, early 20th century. We are both spectators and actors in the great drama of existence. We came forward from the mystery of organic being, and if the theory of evolution's right, through successive layers of expansion, but we're the part of the chambered nautilus that opened up to the infinity and eternity of the cosmos. We are mysterious creatures created in the image of God, and that's what we need to remember as we go forward thinking about the neurobiology of the soul. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.